The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations present The Eternal Light, a program which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today's program, The Story of Isaac and Rebecca, is the third in this Eternal Light series of four talks by Maurice Samuel, author and lecturer, based on his book, Certain People of the Book. Mr. Samuel.
In the traditional Jewish synagogue services of Rosh Hashanah, or the New Year, which Jews all over the world are going to celebrate in a few days, the story of Isaac, the second patriarch, Isaac the son of Abraham, the first patriarch, is read forth from the Bible. It is about Isaac and about the picture I have drawn of him in Certain People of the Book that I shall talk today. Those who have even an elementary acquaintance with the Bible know that the two most dramatic incidents in Isaac's life were separated by a long interval. The first incident was the near sacrifice of Isaac on an altar to God. This took place in his boyhood. The second incident was Isaac's transmission of the Abrahamic blessing to his son Jacob instead of to his older son Esau. This took place in Isaac's old age. And it is usually supposed to have taken place as the result of a deception carried out by Rebekah, Isaac's wife and the mother of the two sons, on her blind old husband. I am going to offer you my picture of Isaac as these incidents reveal him. Isaac was 12 or 13 years old when his father Abraham was commanded by God to take Isaac to a certain place. It happened to be Mount Moriah, where the temple was later built, and sacrifice him there. The Bible tells us at the outset that God did not intend to have the sacrifice carried out. He only wanted to test Abraham. But Abraham did not know that till the last moment, neither did Isaac. Much thought has been rightly expended on the utter devotion of Abraham. This was his son by the true wife. This was his heir and the continuer of the Jewish faith. But not enough thought has been expended on Isaac the boy. The Bible calls him the lad. We are told that Isaac was a meditative man. In the evenings, he used to go out into the fields to meditate. I can imagine that the incident of the near sacrifice left a permanent impression on Isaac's mind. Not a trauma, but a permanent, quiet exaltation. There he had lain on the altar, bound to it. The faggots of wood had been heaped up around him. The knife was uplifted, it was about to be plunged into him, and when life had departed from him, this wood was going to be kindled. And Isaac uttered no word of protest, did not plead for his life. A skeptic would say that Isaac never believed he would be sacrificed. He saw it all as a make-believe. It was incredible that his father would actually plunge the knife into him or draw it across his throat. But if we take this view, then we have to regard the whole story as being not only silly, but in bad taste. Certainly not something to be written down and passed on from generation to generation. No, if there is any sense at all in the episode, and there is a great deal, we have to think of Isaac as expecting death and willing to embrace it, because this was his father and his father's God, and they could not mean him harm. Whatever they did was for his good. We may say of Isaac that he passed in his boyhood through the valley of the shadow of death, and that made him a thoughtful man. There was certainly a great difference between him and the other two patriarchs, Abraham, his father, and Jacob, his son. By comparison with Isaac's life, the lives of Abraham and of Jacob were adventurous. It's true, we are told that Jacob was a quiet man dwelling in tents. All the same, he left his home after the quarrel with his brother Esau and went to Syria to live with his uncle Laban. There he served 14 years for his two wives, Rachel and Leah. We read that on the way back to the Holy Land, Jacob wrestled with an angel and got the better of him. And on his deathbed, Jacob was able to say to his son Joseph, I have given thee one portion more than thy brothers, which I took out of the hand of the Amorite with my sword and my bow. And in his very old age, Jacob went down to Egypt to join his son Joseph. Jacob was a traveler, so was Abraham. And although Abraham meditated much on God, he was a man of action. He fought with men, and in a sense he fought with God. When his nephew Lot was carried off by the armies of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Abraham set out with a few hundred household retainers, caught up with Amraphel and his allies, defeated them, and rescued Lot. When God was about to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, Abraham argued with him, bargained with him. If 50 righteous men were to be found in those cities, or 45, or 40, or 30, even 20, even 10, God ought not to destroy the cities. And God yielded ground. 40, 45, 40, 30, 20, 10. And only then did Abraham give up. Abraham was born in Mesopotamia. In his youth, he moved to the city of Haran. From Haran, he went to the Holy Land. He went down to Egypt and came back to the Holy Land. But Isaac was all meditation. He was born in the Promised Land and he stayed there all his life. He did not, like Jacob, go to Mesopotamia to get a wife. At Abraham's command, Eliezer the servant went there for him and brought back Rebekah. When there was a famine in the Holy Land, Isaac stayed on. God said to him, go not down into Egypt. In his old age, he became blind, perhaps from too much study, a risk which few of us run nowadays. He lay in his tent, thinking, always thinking about God and man, and about the great promise and the blessing, and about his two sons, Jacob and Esau, who, although born to Rebekah within half an hour or so of each other, were so utterly different that it was hard to believe that they came from the same parents. Jacob, I have just mentioned, was a quiet man dwelling in tents. He was a thinker as well as a man of action. But Esau was a cunning hunter, a man of the field. A man of the field, a man given over completely to the fury of the chase. And not because he needed to be like primitive man, but because that was his passion. Esau was a throwback, an atavism. The peaceful life of the agricultural age was not to his taste. He loved the chase and the smell of blood. And then there was the promise and the blessing, the heritage, which Isaac had to bestow on one of his two sons. We have to understand that promise and blessing and what they meant. We can sum it up in one brief utterance that God made to Abraham. I will make of thee a great nation, and in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. That promise and blessing God had bestowed on Isaac after Abraham's death, for a reason which is immediately made clear. God said to Isaac, I will establish the oath I swore unto Abraham thy father. I will multiply thy seed as the stars of heaven, and by thy seed shall all the nations of the earth bless themselves, because Abraham hearkened to my voice and kept my charges, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. To Isaac it must have been clear from the beginning that Esau was not the kind of man to accept this kind of heritage. What was there about a cunning hunter and a man of the field for the nations of the earth to bless themselves with? It would have been a mockery and a piece of cruelty to force such a heritage on Esau. That is, if Esau had been able to understand it. And yet we are told with the utmost clarity, Isaac loved Esau because he did eat of his venison, and Rebekah loved Jacob. This is an important statement, and we must analyze it in its context. We are told, Isaac sowed in the land and found in the same year 100-fold, and he had possessions of flocks and possession of herds and a great household. In short, Isaac was a rich man. At the same time, Isaac loved Esau because he did eat of his venison. The hasty reader will infer that Isaac loved Esau the hunter for the sake of food. This is an impossible, I may even say, a ludicrous inference. It turns Isaac into a gourmet. It implies that the way to Isaac's heart lay through his stomach. It is my surmise that half the time Isaac didn't know what he was eating. He was so sunk in meditation. A little meditation of our own sets us right. All we need do is imagine Esau, the uncouth hunter, coming into Isaac's tent with a fresh killed animal, saying, "Here, father, I've brought you a nice fat antelope." And Isaac thinking, "Poor, hopeless boy. He loves me, and that's all he can think of to please me." What that sentence means is that Isaac did eat of Esau's venison because he loved the boy. There's nothing unusual about a father or mother having a special love for a mentally handicapped child. But that sentence, "and Rebekah loved Jacob," does it mean that she had no love for Esau? By no means. You remember how Sarah, the mother of Isaac, banished into the wilderness Abraham's other son, Ishmael, by another wife, or concubine. Rebekah didn't think of banishing Esau into the wilderness. The fact is that Esau went into the wilderness to join his wild uncle Ishmael and went of his own accord. Esau had no taste for the civilized life. Nor must we suppose that there was discord between Isaac and Rebekah in regard to their children. The fact that Rebekah loved Esau too is established by a cry of hers when she learned that Esau planned to kill Jacob. "Why should I be bereaved of you both in one day?" Now, though there wasn't discord, there was some disagreement. Rebekah knew just as well as Isaac that Esau was hopeless as a carrier of the blessing. She knew his future would be in the desert. Isaac, however, believed that it would do the boy good at least to stay in the vicinity of the blessing or its bearers. And now we come to the famous incident of the sale of the blessing by Esau, the firstborn, to Isaac, the secondborn. This is what we read. "And Jacob boiled some soup, and Esau came in from the field, and he was faint. And Esau said to Jacob, 'Let me swallow, I pray thee, some of that red, red soup, for I am faint.' And Jacob said, 'Sell me first thy birthright.' And Esau said, 'I am at the point of death, I am dying, and what profit shall the birthright do me?' And Jacob said, 'Swear to me first.' And he swore to him. And Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil soup, and he did eat and drink and rose up and went his way. So Esau despised his birthright." This is one of the most bewildering passages in the Bible. It is commonly pictured as follows. On a certain day, in the household of the enormously wealthy sheikh Isaac ben Abraham, one of his two sons, Jacob by name, a quiet, studious, stay-at-home young man, is cooking some soup, presumably for himself. To him enters his twin brother Esau, the man of the field, faint from a day's hunting or several days' hunting. He is practically in articulo mortis from hunger. We take it that he staggers in or reels or crawls in with the last of his energies. We are now to suppose that for some mysterious reason the immense establishment is deserted, but for those two young men. And there is no one but Jacob to witness the dying man's condition and to bring him succor. Esau himself is too exhausted to go in search of food, or he thinks it futile, being convinced for another mysterious reason that everything edible has vanished, together with all the members of the huge household, and that his only hope of life is the hated brother and his lentil soup. He is certainly too weak to throw himself on the solitary cook and wrest the food from him. So in the whisper of the dying, he bargains for it. And it is a hard as well as a fantastic bargain that the younger brother drives. Nothing less than the birthright, the blessing, the inheritance. Solemnly under oath, almost with his dying breath, the older brother delivers the birthright. And the narrator winds up scornfully with the words, "So Esau despised his birthright." The astonishing thing here is the narrator's scorn. Surely a man cannot be accused of despising a great treasure because he has to ransom his life with it. But let us suppose that the narrator is a moralist of the sternest breed, and we agree with him, and he thinks it despicable in a man to save his life by selling or even pretending to sell his spiritual birthright. It is a noble thing to be a martyr. It is not a despicable thing to be afraid of death. Does the incident, as here portrayed, place Esau in that life and death dilemma? It certainly does not, as I shall show in a moment. And if it did, we should have to answer another baffling question. If Jacob was villain enough to extort that sale, he was also a fool. All he had to do was walk away with the bread and the soup and let his brother die of hunger. Then the birthright would have reverted to him automatically. There would have been no sale under duress, and no seller would have survived to complain. But these difficulties are of our own making. We have unconsciously doctored the story to justify our prejudice against Esau, or in our over-anxiety to show that the Bible can't be wrong. And now we are tripped up by our own superfluous ingenuity. Our defense of the Bible is as unnecessary as it is unconvincing. It all comes out right if we stick to the text. Nowhere in it are we told that Esau was on the point of death for lack of a crust and a bowl of soup. It is Esau who makes the statement, and it is implausible. We are told that Esau was faint and that he said to his brother, "Let me swallow, I pray thee, some of that red, red soup." And his brother said, "Sell me first that birthright." And instead of snarling, "This is no time for stupid jokes," or "Are you out of your mind?" or "You go to the devil, I'd rather die first," Esau pants, "I am dying. What profit shall the birthright do me?" This from the hunter, the man of the field, who knew what it was to stalk his prey from sunrise to sunset. It was not to save his life that Esau surrendered his birthright. The tickling smell of the hot soup in his nostrils crowded out everything else. What he said, in effect, was, "I'm dying for a taste of that hot soup." The mind of primitive man is not easy to analyze. I cannot get a picture of Esau's ideas. He believed that the sale of the birthright under duress, or seeming duress, was valid. And yet he continued to consider himself entitled to the birthright. We know this because at the end, when Isaac gave the Abrahamic blessing to Jacob, Esau complained that Jacob had supplanted him. So he believed and didn't believe that the sale was valid. The capacity to hold two contradictory beliefs is characteristic of primitive man. It also occurs among civilized men. I think most of you know what happened next. Blind old Isaac lay in his tent meditating on the time at hand when for him there would be no more meditation on earth. We happen to know that he still had many years of life before him, but he thought otherwise. We read, "When Isaac was old and his eyes were dim so that he could not see, he called Esau, the elder son, and said to him, 'Take, I pray thee, thy weapons, thy quiver and thy bow, and go out into the field and take me venison, and bring me savory food such as I love, and bring it to me that I may eat, that my soul may bless thee before I die.' And Rebekah heard when Isaac spoke to Esau." As soon as Esau had left, Rebekah called in Jacob and said, "Go now to the flock and fetch me two good kids of the goats, and I will make savory food for thy father, and thou shalt bring it to thy father, so that he may bless thee before his death. And Jacob said to Rebekah his mother, Behold, Esau my brother is a hairy man, and I am a smooth man. My father will perhaps feel me, and I shall seem to him to be a mocker, and I shall bring a curse upon me, not a blessing. And thus old Isaac was to be tricked into giving the Abrahamitic blessing to Jacob instead of Esau. Isaac was blind, but he could feel. So Rebekah sewed strips of goat skin on Jacob's hands. Isaac still had his sense of smell, so Rebekah made Jacob put on Esau's clothes, which smelt of the fields and not of the midnight lamp. But what about the sense of taste? If Isaac was such a gourmet and so loved venison, how could he possibly mistake domestic goat's meat for wild venison? That is where you have the proof that Isaac was not a gourmet. I have asked a dozen country women of Rebekah's, though of course of a later generation, whether Rebekah could there and then in her place and time, and without previous experimentation, have prepared kid in such a way as to make it taste like venison. I will not say to a gourmet, but to a person of ordinary palatal discrimination. And I have never received anything but a compassionate negative. So in the so-called deception which was about to take place, four of the five senses had been accounted for: sight, touch, smell, and taste. There remained the fifth sense, hearing, and apparently there was nothing to be done about that. With one sense neutralized and three deceived, Rebekah seems to have hoped that the fifth would be dragged along. So it was, though with some difficulty, for as you remember, Isaac was puzzled. When Jacob brought the dish in and said he was Esau, Isaac felt his hands, which were covered with goatskin, and said, The voice is the voice of Jacob, but the hands are the hands of Esau. Now, as I see it, no deception took place. Isaac knew perfectly that it was Jacob and not Esau who stood before him. He pretended to be deceived, and he blessed Jacob as if he were Esau. Let me read the words of the blessing. See, the smell of my son is as the smell of a field which the Lord hath blessed. So God give thee of the dew of heaven and of the fat places of the earth, and plenty of corn and wine. Let people serve thee, and nations bow down to thee. Be Lord over thy brethren, and let thy mother's sons bow down to thee. Cursed be every one that curseth thee, and blessed be every one that blesseth thee. But this is not the Abrahamitic blessing at all. Where is the mention of Abraham? Where is the implication of service to other peoples? This is an ordinary, earthly, and earthy, quite unrelated to the divine purpose which had been accepted by Abraham and passed on to Isaac for transmission to their posterity. If you want further proof, you will find it in what happened next. Esau returned from the hunt with his venison, prepared it, and brought it in to Isaac. And Esau said to his father, Let my father arise and eat of his son's venison, that thy soul may bless me. And Isaac his father said to him, Who art thou? And Esau answered, I am thy son, thy firstborn son, Esau. And Isaac trembled exceedingly and said, Who then is he that hath taken venison and brought it to me, and have eaten of all before thou camest, and have blessed him? Yea, and he shall be blessed. When Esau heard the words of his father, he cried with an exceeding great and bitter cry, and said, Bless me, even me also, O my father. And Jacob said, Thy brother came with guile, and hath taken away the blessing. In the midst of our sympathy with Esau, we can't help smiling at the way the unhappy old man betrays himself. To him it is still venison. What an affront to Esau, who all those years had imagined that his father loved him because he brought him venison, and here Isaac is as much as telling him, I really can't tell the difference between ordinary kid's meat and the venison you've been bringing me. But Esau was too bewildered to get it. Instead of crying out, What venison? Whose venison? He said, Hast thou not reserved a blessing for me? And Isaac blessed him in the following words. Behold, of the fat places of the earth shall be thy dwelling, and of the dew of heaven from above. And by thy sword shalt thou live, and thou shalt serve thy brother. And it shall come to pass, when thou shalt break loose, thou shalt shake his yoke from thy neck. Compare the two blessings. What is there about this second blessing to embitter Esau? What more would he have got as the first comer, except some flourishes and a temporary overlordship? The second blessing, too, promises the fat places. Corn and wine are implied, and Esau is promised that he will live by the sword, but he is not a quiet man dwelling in tents, and the prospect of living by the sword does not displease him. Now, Esau hadn't heard the terms of the first blessing. He must have suspected that it was infinitely finer than the second one, when, as a matter of fact, it was more or less the same. We read, And Esau said in his heart, Let the days of mourning for my father be at hand. Then I will slay my brother Jacob. He obviously expected Isaac to die soon. Apparently everyone did, including Isaac. But Esau didn't say those words only in his heart. He must have gone about the camp muttering them, because we read that Rebekah said to Jacob, Thy brother Esau doth purpose to kill thee. Now therefore, my son, arise and flee to my brother Laban in Paddan Aram. And that was what Jacob did. He fled from the country to Haran in Mesopotamia, but before he set out on the journey, he went in to Isaac to say farewell and to ask for the blessing. Or rather, Isaac sent for him. It is clear that Isaac was not angry with Jacob. And Isaac gives Jacob the true blessing. God Almighty bless thee, and make thee fruitful, and multiply thee, that thou mayest be a congregation of peoples, and give thee the blessing of Abraham to thee and thy seed with thee. There it is, the blessing of Abraham, which is in essence not a blessing for prosperity and power. We must always bear in mind that God promised earthly greatness to others, to Ishmael. To Ammon and Moab he assigned permanent territories. But of no one else was it said, In thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. This Abrahamitic blessing is compounded of duties and responsibilities, of wrestling with the Spirit for a knowledge of God, and of enduring faithfulness to an idea. There will be lapses and returns, sin and repentance, punishment and forgiveness, but it will last forever.
Just heard the third in this Eternal Light series of four talks by Maurice Samuel, author and lecturer, based on his book, Certain People of the Book, published by Alfred A. Knopf, Incorporated. Due to the holiday of Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, the Eternal Light will not be heard next week. Be with us 2 weeks from today for the fourth program in this Eternal Light series, The Reluctant Deliverer. The Eternal Light is produced under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This pre-recorded program has been an NBC Public Affairs presentation. This is the NBC Radio Network.